and welcome to the Road to Genome podcast. This episode is being brought to you jointly by the Genomic Medicine Services in the Northeast and Yorkshire and the East of England. I'm your host, Helen Bethel, Genetic Counsellor and NEY Workforce Development and Education Lead. Today we come to you from the School of Clinical Medicine, part of Addenbrookes Hospital in Cambridge. I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Eddie Blair, Vice Chair of the Patient and Public Voice Forum here at the East GMSA. So, hi, Eddie.
Hi, Helen.
Hi. Thanks so much for joining us. Can you start by telling me a little bit about your personal or professional journey that has brought you into the world of genomics?
That has got two separate paths. Mm-hmm. One path, I'd say, is the professional path. So I am a scientist, first degree is in biochemistry. PhD is in biochemical virology. So mm-hmm. I studied viruses.
Okay.
You know, up from 1981 onwards. Mm-hmm. And then I went to do what they call a postdoc in the US. So I went to California because, again, the rain there was much less than it was in Glasgow, which is much less than it was in London. So I went to California, did a postdoc there to learn molecular, what they call molecular techniques, and that's techniques involving DNA and genetic analysis and stuff like that. So although my first degree had a formal genetics in it, where you look at fruit flies and nematodes and stuff like that, I went to California to really learn the new genetics of actually manipulating DNA and recreating, in my case, it was recreating viruses that carried different things in them. So then I came back and I decided academia was interesting, but I wanted to try and make my research a bit more applied. So I joined what was then Wellcome Research Labs in Beckenham and Kent. I worked initially on HIV because when I came back in 1988, HIV was a relatively new virus. AIDS was still a relatively new disease. And so a lot of the pharma companies were beginning to work in that area. So I joined early on to do molecular biology of HIV. And the interesting thing is that at the time we were genetically manipulating HIV. So we're changing HIV, trying to make it grow. And one of the things we're trying to do was make it less sensitive to existing drugs.
Okay.
So we could understand what happened in the clinic when a patient stopped responding to mm-hmm. HIV drugs. What was the genetic mutations in HIV that caused that?
Mm-hmm.
And we'd get these patient samples, we'd sequence them and say, there's a change there, and there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd take these changes individually and in combination and see how that affected the ability of the virus to grow in the presence of these drugs.
Wow.
Now, at the time I thought, yeah, this is just routine, standard molecular virology. But after the COVID stuff and all the hoo-ha around, was it a lab-created mm-hmm. variant?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you realise then that you were doing something potentially quite dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the containment was all super regulated, but even so, at the time, I wasn't blasé about it, but I didn't think about it. But it was interesting to do that, create an organism that had a behaviour that was entirely different.
Yeah.
And one of the neat things we did was to say, this change in the virus's genetic material results in this change in a viral protein.
Mm-hmm.
And the effect in that viral protein is that it is no longer inhibited by the drug that mm-hmm. targets that viral protein. Mm-hmm. And so we were able to look at how those genetic changes changed the structure at the atomic level of this protein that then led to clinical effects.
Yeah.
So what we'd done was at an atomic level worked out the basis for clinical resistance. And I don't think there's many examples of that.
That's incredible.
Ever. You know, there are some, but that's one of my small claims to being quite excited.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
Of course, that excitement then keeps you going in mm-hmm. genetics. And, you know, pharma companies work in cycles. So for many years, they worked in antibiotics, antibacterials and antifungals. That fell out of fashion, but antivirals come in, particularly HIV and herpes and stuff like that. Then it goes out of cycle and they start to look at cancer became the next big thing, and then respiratory disease, and then more recently neurosciences. So my career has taken me through those three disease areas. So most recently, I still worked in pharma. I was working in neurosciences, but I'd worked in cancer earlier on. And particularly in the cancer stuff, I was working on a new way of treating cancer, which is to make cancer cells more visible to the immune system so that the immune system attacks them. So you're not attacking them with the drug directly. You're using the medicine or the drug or the biopharmaceutical to expose the cancer to the immune system. And that's what's given that these really exciting results in things like melanoma and lung cancer. And of course, what drives me on is I really like that approach to develop for prostate cancer, so that although I was told my prostate cancer is incurable, A, I don't believe that, but I also think that developments in medicine, particularly these immunotherapies for cancer, and we'll come on to some other things maybe later, will give me an opportunity of perhaps having a cure of this previously incurable cancer. So it's exciting times in science, but that's a long answer for how did you get into genetics professionally. Now, personally, I joined the Patient and Public Voice panel 2 years ago. And about 2 weeks after I joined the panel, I got my diagnosis of prostate cancer. I was asymptomatic, no idea what was going on. Went to my GP, he did the digital rectal exam, and then he did a PSA test, and the PSA test was very high. And so they put me on the two-week fast track. So within 2 weeks, I'd had a second PSA, it confirmed it was high. The urologist I first met made an initial diagnosis based on the exceedingly high PSA that it was probably metastatic stage 4 prostate cancer. They had me in, did biopsies, took biopsies from the prostate, 12 samples, all 12 were positive. So it was confirmed that it was stage 4 prostate cancer. So that changed my interest in the PPV, which was really about educating patients about genetics and genomics, to suddenly being a patient myself and having to come to terms with the genetic issues I might face. So that's why there is a professional pathway, but the personal pathway is a little bit more recent. Although family have had cancer, and my wife had breast cancer, my mother died from a brain metastasis of her lung cancer. You know, it's never really affected me that personally until it's yourself. And that's where I've started to use the PPV to put my voice to reassure particularly men, but other cancer patients that, you know, when he says to you it's cancer, it doesn't mean you're going to die next week. When he says to you it's stage 1, 2, 3, or 4, that's just the way they assess it. It doesn't mean you're going to die any sooner. When they say it's incurable, now it might be incurable, future it might not be. So I do quite a few talks to public meetings and stuff, particularly prostate cancer, 1 in 4 men of Afro-Caribbean descent, 1 in 4 men will get prostate cancer. It's 1 in 8 in Caucasians. And so educating those men, Afro-Caribbean men, about the risks and to feel emboldened to ask about getting a treatment or getting a diagnosis and then a treatment is quite important because they're at a huge risk. You know, they get diagnosed late stage and it's terminal when they get diagnosed. So the mortality rates amongst Afro-Caribbeans is phenomenal, and it's a big, big gap. So that's where a lot of my stuff is done with the Patient Public Voice. So that's one of the things that drives me. And I guess it's a little bit of a distraction from my situation, but not such a big distraction because it's always there. But I'm feeling helping as well, learning from my situation and you know, teaching. So
yeah. So that, you know, I'm sorry to hear about your diagnosis and
happens,
to have come,
you know, yes,
so close to, as you say, your, you know, quite ironic that you'd just taken on this patient voice role. How did it feel for you being on that patient side of the fence rather than the scientist in the lab?
It was, you know, it didn't seem odd. It just seemed that suddenly here was me getting a perspective that I'd always kind of taken for granted, because when I worked within the pharmaceutical industry, my career not only moved into different disease areas, so as I say, through viruses, cancer, respiratory, and then neuro, I'd also moved from drug hunting in the lab through to drug development in the clinic. So I was writing these clinical protocols, and on it I'd say, yeah, patient comes in at week 8, gives a blood sample. Patient comes in at week 12, gives, you know, a lung biopsy or a tissue biopsy. Week 42, patient gets a scan. It could be this scan, could be that. Should we do an MRI scan? Yeah, they do an MRI. That would be really useful to know. Not essential, but useful. So writing these things, dumping them on patients and think, yeah, fine, they'll do it.
Yeah.
But then when you become a patient,
yeah,
and I'm on a clinical study myself now, and I've seen the protocol and I've looked at the schedule and stuff, I'm getting scans every 6 weeks. And, you know, so I have to sit in a little tunnel, claustrophobic tunnel, every 6 weeks. And suddenly I've got that realization that if I'd my time again writing clinical protocols, I'd be a bit more sensitive about what's essential to understanding how the drug is working, and not putting in stuff that was nice to know but we didn't need to know. And it's just an elaboration because it helped with the clinical research but not the clinical development. So I guess that's one thing, is appreciating the patient perspective better, which is why being in the PPV now, I enjoy it so much. Being vice chair, I do chairs that occasionally. I do sit in for meetings for the chair. I do represent the PPV at various meetings. And I'm always trying to give the patient perspective. But the flip side is, with all my scientific knowledge, I can actually talk with some depth and some clarity about what patients might expect and what it will mean for them. Because that's often what they ask is, you know, I've been asked to go for a genetic test. What does that involve? Does it mean I can't get insurance anymore? Or does it mean I need to tell my wife and kids that, you know, their life is in danger as well? No, it's not. This is what it does. And there's data protection around it. And the information it gives you is very, very specific and will help. And I think that reassurance coming from me, not just as a lay person, but as someone with an informed knowledge behind it, really helps.
Yeah, it's an incredible skill mix that you've got, Eddie, from that.
Yeah.
You know, I have to say, hearing you talk initially about your experience of being in the lab, so I was doing my degree in genetics in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Right.
So to hear from a scientist that was doing the practice of what I was learning of the theory of at that time is incredible to hear.
So you didn't get to play with fruit flies then?
Oh, yeah.
You did? Oh, yeah. Everyone loves
I wasn't very good at it, as my lab partner at the time would confirm, but yeah, we were.
You've all seen fruit flies because they're around your rotten bananas and your decaying melons.
Yeah. That's I know, and I often do think of them in that kind of domestic scenario compared to the scientific one where we were, you know, kind of breeding them into different patterns.
Brilliant.
So, absolutely. But no, amazing to hear from, as I say, the scientists that were kind of doing, you know, the real virus alterations what have you I was learning about in textbooks. It's you know, it's fantastic to meet you from that perspective. So thinking about your journey then so far, as you know, both as a patient and from a PPV, what has been the most challenging part of it for you so far?
The challenging part, I guess, for me individually, it's not been that challenging because, as you can probably tell, I'm very well motivated, very excited by the use of genomics and genetics in modern approaches to medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So that excites me. The challenge has been, as a PPV, as a group, it's often difficult because it's partly voluntary.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult to get continued engagement occasionally. And one of the things that we've tried to do, so I've interviewed now three or four new candidates, mm-hmm. potential candidates for a PPV. And for starts, it's hard to find candidates mm-hmm. because not everyone wants to do this public voice mm-hmm. thing. Then when you get them, we're really getting good at assessing, are these people in it for the long term?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, will they get fed up after a couple of meetings and say, you know, it's different from what I thought.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not getting as much out of this as I can. So one of the things I try and do, certainly when we chair it, but when we're putting together an agenda for our regular meetings, is to make sure we offer engagement to people.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a mix of information delivery, you know, like whatever. Southeast GMSA is very, very proactive in educational material. So mm-hmm. we've done a lot of stuff from them on educational material. For me, it's simplistic, but it's correct. It's accurate. Mm-hmm. So we do a little bit of that. We hear from them and see how we can use their material mm-hmm. to get into this. But we also have our own groups within Addenbrookes or the Eastern Genomics Region
mm-hmm.
talking about the things they're doing as well. So, mm-hmm. so you know, Julian Barwell and Joe Lau that you've talked to, they're two people I just think are fantastic from the region who really help patients understand the genetic journey as well. So that's been one of the good things is meeting lots of good people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, within our own PPV, we've got a number of really good people. We're not great in diversity yet, so we're all mainly white people. We've got mm-hmm. very few, I don't think we've got any Afro-Caribbean men. We've tried so hard to get them mm-hmm. involved. We've got some women who are non-Caucasian, but, you know, most of the group is white men and women, all of about 50 to 60 years. So our diversity isn't that that's great.
Been wrong.
So, mm-hmm. so one of the things that we're really driving within East Genomics, and Joe Lowry is a person driving it, is equality, diversity, and inclusion. Because mm-hmm. EDI, a lot of it is lip service, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I really want EDI to be an important part of what mm-hmm. we do as a PPV. And that mm-hmm. starts partly with membership, but also with who we're reaching out to mm-hmm. to say, this is what your journey is going to look like. And as I say, I played dominoes with Afro-Caribbean men.
Yeah.
And can you say this in the podcast? I think they cheat. They cheat worse than golfers, right? I play golf, and some of the guys I play at golf can't count either. But anyway, but in sitting and talking to them, dominoes is a great leveler, a distraction that allows them to talk a bit more freely. And, mm-hmm. you know, they may well be a little bit suspicious of a white man giving them information or advice.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, look, my prostate's the same size as yours, the disease is the same, your risk is just that little bit higher,
mm-hmm.
you know, do something about it. And it's really one of the things in prostate that we're trying to drive, and this is Prostate Cancer UK,
mm-hmm.
I don't think they believe they can get PSA testing on the screening register, but mm-hmm. what they can do is try and make it easier for men to get a PSA test.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as I say, for me, with advanced prostate cancer, it's a no-brainer, it's very clear. And probably for locally advanced, it's the same. So there's some ambiguity around the PSA test at stage 1 and stage 2 disease. But still, men asking for the PSA test and GPs not refusing to give it to them, because a lot of GPs have an old guideline that says, you know, the PSA test is flawed, try and avoid using it, better have a digital rectal examination, then maybe get referred for some, you know, a biopsy mm-hmm. or a scan. Whereas now there's some sense that the PSA test and even self-testing with a finger prick of your own blood and a test at home, that's something that's come in. So the PSA test is something that I think will drive better diagnosis in the coming years. And Prostate Cancer UK is really behind that, and particularly making GPs aware.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that's something I think I want to drive for prostate cancer. But in terms of PPV, there's so much more to be done. You know, we'll come on to some examples maybe in a moment.
I'd love to hear about your examples of your PPV work.
Oh, the PPV, firstly, I mean, technology is phenomenally exciting. So there's three things I think are fantastic. There's the rise of AI.
Mm-hmm.
Now, can AI be a good thing in healthcare? It probably can, but everything, it needs curation,
mm-hmm.
right? It needs someone to say, this is bad advice. Mm-hmm. Let's not have this in there. Or this is a bad algorithm. Mm-hmm. Let's not use that. But AI, I think it's a buzz at the moment, but I think AI can be very, very good for mm-hmm. healthcare. The second thing that's very exciting is new diagnostic tests. And one of them is called, the acronym CTDNA.
Mm-hmm.
So it stands for circulating tumor DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does, it takes a sample from your blood
mm-hmm.
and it can extract and enrich for DNA that's come from a tumor. If the tumours are there and it's come from it, tumours shed DNA and it can capture and identify and analyse that DNA
mm-hmm.
and tell you, yes, this is from a tumour.
Mm-hmm.
It may also be able to tell you where that tumour's from.
Mm-hmm.
If the anatomical diagnosis hasn't been made,
mm-hmm.
then they may be able to tell you from other patterns
mm-hmm.
where that's from. And secondly, if it's got a variation in it
mm-hmm.
that guides response to treatment. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, BRCA2 is something that they talk mm-hmm. about a lot. If you've got the BRCA2 mutation in prostate cancer, you can be treated with a thing called olaparib,
mm-hmm.
which is a wonderful treatment, but only if you've got BRCA2. Mm-hmm. So if you can do CTDA, find BRCA2, for instance,
mm-hmm.
olaparib goes straight in as part of your regimen.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't need any tissue biopsies. It doesn't need you to undergo any surgery. So mm-hmm. circulating tumour DNA is a very exciting technology.
Yeah.
And then in terms of treatment, what COVID did, I mean, COVID did a lot of bad things, we know, but COVID also did a lot of good things. And one of the good things was the development of RNA vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that RNA technology, which changed the time frame of developing vaccines from, let's say, 10 to 15 years to 1 year, which is mm-hmm. phenomenal, that technology has then moved into personalized cancer treatments, mm-hmm. personalized cancer vaccines. So again, with ctDNA, or it's currently going to involve tissue biopsies, you can look at a tumor tissue, sequence it and say, these markers in the surface of the cancer, mm-hmm. to call them tumor antigens, in the surface of the cancer, they're very high in this individual. So if we incorporate that into an RNA vaccine and we zap that into them, then you start to generate potentially an immune response.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I worked at Glaxo many years ago, we're trying to develop a vaccine for melanoma and it just did not work.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it didn't work is cancer cells are very clever in that they induce a thing called tolerance, mm-hmm. which is what we all have to stop us send their immune system against our organs or things, you know, mm-hmm. our blood cells, whatever. There's now treatments that break tolerance for cancer.
Mm-hmm.
They're called immunotherapies or checkpoint inhibitors. If you give a vaccine with a checkpoint inhibitor, it takes a break off the cancer and the vaccine can work better.
Mm-hmm.
So those three things, you know, AI, ctDNA, and checkpoint immunotherapies with vaccines,
mm-hmm.
its future's tremendously exciting, initially for cancer, but they'll take it into other areas like
mm-hmm.
Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, you mm-hmm. know, respiratory disease, some of these horrible motor neuron diseases.
Mm-hmm.
They all may well, you know, benefit from this technology.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's what excites me.
Right. Yeah.
It keeps me going.
Yeah, yeah.
Hi, my name's Naeem Mikalachand and I'm the host of Behind the Genes, Genomics England's podcast. Join us for the latest in cutting-edge research and real-life stories from people affected by rare conditions and cancer. Through thoughtful conversations, we'll take you behind the science. Plus, check out our Genomics 101 explainer episodes, where we break down complex genetic terms in under 10 minutes. Subscribe to Behind the Genes on your favourite podcast app today.
So you mentioned before that from your PPV role, one of the positives was the people that you've been able to come in contact and meet through that role. Is there any other positives that you take from your work?
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things is an insight into how the NHS works.
Mm.
Because again, I've now become a recipient of, I would say, outstanding NHS services. The treatment I get here at Addenbrooke's, not just the treatment, but the management of my disease and treatment. I've got a first-rate oncologist.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a first-rate team around him. And in fact, I've given a talk to that team about the patient perspective.
That's great.
And they really appreciate that because a lot of them are desk-bound or lab-bound, and they're doing this fiddling with little bits of tissue or little bits of data. But for them, they hadn't got that connection. So that's been quite exciting, actually, is to talk to the same clinical team that's actually involved in my treatment. So that's been exciting. But also, you know, the NHS, there's some parts of it just seems to me not modernised yet, you know. So I think, you know, I don't want to go political, but I think throwing money at the NHS isn't the answer. It's like targeted investment in the NHS. So make the things that need to happen, not just say, oh, we need another x-ray machine. There's no point of an x-ray machine if you get no one to run it. So CT and bone scans are part of what I get regularly. There's some good technicians here, but they're run off their feet. They're working long, long hours. So targeted recruitment to positions and stuff like that. So that's been exciting. But the thing that really excites me is the way genomics has been embraced within the NHS. I mean, these genomic medicine service alliances, it's incredible what they're doing, because stuff that I thought would take, you know, we're doing it in pharma years ago, using genetic profiling to decide how we treat an HIV person. And then from that, how do we treat a cancer patient, stuff like that, knowing their genetic information. Just seemed to me a long time before the NHS could do that. But I've come across a wonderful lady called Jude Hayward, who's a GP.
Yeah.
And Jude has been driving, helping GPs understand genetics and genomics. Now, her findings were that our colleagues don't want a 10-week course on genetics and genomics. They want to know stuff just in time.
Yes. Right?
So they want it delivered on a screen. When they've got a patient who's asked about a genetic variation, they can tap in and it comes up in a way that they can immediately understand and pass on. So just in time for GPs seems important. But GPs, I know from the work on PSA, GPs don't have time to renew their understanding of guidelines every 5 minutes. So again, if there's a guideline change, it needs to be bold but simple to execute. And that's the biggest barrier, I think, to GPs embracing genetics and genomics is the time to understand that information without having to commit long hours to, you know, reading books and this stuff. Because I've got a lifetime of genetic research behind me, and that gives me all this knowledge. You can't get that in a 5-minute course, you know. So it's going to have to be simple information. So that's been an insight, is, you know, getting GPs mainstreamed on genetics and genomics. And a sideline is the chap who is a clinical director here is a chap called Richard Sanford, Professor Dick Sanford. He's actually a family friend because my son went to school with his son and then they lived together in London. So we're family friends. But before I joined PPV and I didn't know any about Dick's role in it, I did some lectures for him here because he got some money from Genomics England to run an education course for GPs to learn about genomics. And it was a 10-week course, and GPs had to take a holiday, and I believe they had to self-fund it partly self-fund it, because Dick did get money from Genomics England to do it. And they were fantastic, engaged, but the beepers were going off all the time, you know, because they still had a day job. And although they'd taken leave, if you're a GP, I don't think you're ever away from work.
Mm.
Unless you go to the Hebrides, you know, you're never away. So that's been one of the things that's been very interesting for me in the PPV as part of the NHS under East Genomics and the PPV, is just seeing how the whole thing works. Yeah. And it's interesting.
Yeah, great. So thinking about NHS staff that are at the beginning of introducing their genomics into their professional practice, what one piece of advice would you give them, either with your patient hat on or your PPV hat on?
Right, certainly with patient hat on, I think my advice would be is you have to, at the start of your career, make that effort to understand genetics and genomics. Don't manana it. Don't say, okay, I know I'm coming in as a midwife or a nurse in paediatrics, say, but genetics in paediatrics is very important. So take time to learn genetics that's appropriate for your role. Don't put it off till tomorrow. Get the basics. So if they get the basics, then as more information accumulates, they won't be scrabbling to understand what's this acronym or what's this technology. They'll have that there and they can build in that. So my advice is, A, make the effort to understand it at the outset. That's a PPV view. From a patient point of view, you really want, if you're a patient that really doesn't understand what's going on, you do not want someone who clearly doesn't understand what they're telling you to be telling you about genetics and genomics. So from a patient perspective, it's so important that the person imparting information is not only imparting the right information, but imparting that with a degree of knowledge that gives you comfort. You know, you can pick up immediately if, you know, I had infusion number 13 3 weeks ago, and they said, could a junior nurse come in and insert the cannula?
Yeah.
I thought, well, do I really want that? I said, yes, it's fine. He can do it as long as he's close. He will be closely supervised. You know, the person was absolutely brilliant, absolutely painless. No shaking, no nerves.
Yeah.
And you do need a degree of trust. But I did it because I'm comfortable with that trust and I know what's going on. I think if you're a nervous patient, you pick up on nervousness, or you create nervousness in your provider. So I think the provider, the onus in them, you know, the new person into the career, just know enough to sound plausible.
Yeah.
You know more if you can, but know at least more than the patient is picked up on Dr. Google. Because Dr. Google is the worst thing.
Yeah.
Because people believe what's on the internet is the truth.
I think that echoes really well, Eddie, with what I've tried to do within this education role that I'm currently in, and is that, you know, it's the basics. You know, we don't all need to know how to adapt viruses for HIV. But you just need to know the basics and be confident to say that you're not sure of something with patients as well, to say, you know, well, actually, this is new to my practice. I'm not sure, but I know where we might be able to find that out. So, yeah, so I hope the work that I've done kind of echoes the sentiments that you've just shared there. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've talked about lots of the exciting projects that you're involved with.
Yeah.
If you look to the future now, what one thing would you say is the most exciting bit that's coming down the tracks?
Oh, there's so many exciting things. I mean, part of the problem for our society, and I'm looking around the room at a bunch of younger people than me, so, you know, A, keep paying your taxes because that pays my pension, but B, you know, you're going to grow to be much older than certainly my generation. So old age, living into old age, there's going to be lots of degenerative disease. And I think the challenge is, you can't cure everything. Some mm-hmm. things you might be able to cure, but you can't mm-hmm. cure everything. But you'll be living with disease and living with a quality of life. So HIV, mm-hmm. people now live with HIV. Mm-hmm. People live with cancer. Mm-hmm. People don't live with Alzheimer's at the moment. Mm-hmm. They eventually die from Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. It's a long degenerative mm-hmm. disease. Now, that might be something where the degeneration can be halted, reversed, mm-hmm. you know, they call it disease modifying. So that might happen. So the question for me, or the concern for me, is that we're all going to live longer. Mm-hmm. We may well have a better quality of life, but we all die at some point. Mm-hmm. So I think it's about living a fulfilled life, mm-hmm. living to a point where you feel comfortable with death. Mm-hmm. And you die happy, because that is the fate of, mm-hmm. you know, men and women. We're not invincible. We do have to go. But we're going to live much longer. And I don't know what society is going to be like mm-hmm. in 50 years, for instance, 100 years. Will they all be old people that drive badly, like into Edinburgh's car park? Or will we have a fulfilled life and we'll all be active, and then suddenly it's just multiple organ failure, that's it, cacked, gone. It's a good death, you know. So that's what I think genomics and genetics can contribute to, is a better quality of life. Live longer, feel better, you know.
Yeah. So where do you think your ambition will take you next then?
Ooh, ambition, yeah. So as well as this role, I'm on the board of a place called the Quadrum Institute in Norwich. And it is about microbiome mm-hmm. research. So it's about how your gut mm-hmm. affects your health mm-hmm. and disease. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that living longer, feeling better, is really about understanding diet, microbiome, the mm-hmm. contribution to health. Mm-hmm. Because your gut flora, they metabolize what you eat mm-hmm. and make little chemicals. And those little chemicals are signals. And some of those signals might go around, say, cancer cell, grow now. Mm-hmm. Or some of those signals might end up in your brain and say, deep think more and stay mm-hmm. active. So, you know, that for me, the gut brain, gut health, gut disease axis is something very interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the challenges in society is to help people understand that you don't just eat foods in isolation. It's mm-hmm. got a big impact on your health and well-being. And, you know, you can do it for yourself. You mm-hmm. don't need someone to do it for me. Mm-hmm. And that's probably the biggest annoyance for me, is people not taking responsibility mm-hmm. for their own lives in some ways. Now, not everyone can do that, because there's people with horrible situations, horrible conditions, who can't do that mm-hmm. and they are compromised. But if you're well enough to look after yourself, mm-hmm. start in childhood. So it's really about parenting, mm-hmm. grandparenting, parenting in kids. If the kids grow up proper, mm-hmm. then they'll have a long and happy life. If they're misfed or mistreated, or they're not made to be active, you know, mm-hmm. get involved. Because sports isn't just about running around. Sports is a great socialising thing as well. So mm-hmm. there's all these skills to be learned from doing that thing. So for me, it's really making a broader societal awareness of how simple things like diet and food mm-hmm. have long-term implications, and you must start now, not think, again, mañana. I hate mañana attitude. Yeah. So that would be my big thing.
Yeah.
That would keep me excited. Quadrum is a tremendous, exciting place. There's so much going on there. There's good genetics goes on there. The connection with Norfolk and Norwich Hospital out in that Norwich Science Park is very important. Norwich can't yet rival Cambridge or Oxford or parts of London, but it can get there. Same as Birmingham can, and Coventry and York, you know.
Yeah.
There's lots of places I should mention. So Sunderland, I suppose. And,
yeah.
And I don't know. Sheffield.
I'm
hoping to get everyone that's listening to this happy.
It's really interesting, Eddie, that it almost feels like in some ways you've kind of come full circle within your career, you know, so kind of those really early days of that virus and understanding its interaction with drugs and why it was resisting it, to now understanding how those factors from our biome are then affecting our genetics and affecting our development. It's that real epigenetic kind of full circle. And I
Correct.
Think this
yes.
is where we are literally just at the very beginning of scratching the surface. I often feel that we know a lot about genetics, but actually it's the black and white that we know, the bit of the moderate risk, the low risk, the factors in our environment and our epigenetics that affect that, I think is just, we've barely even scratched the surface of it. So it's incredible to hear how you're bringing all your, you know, amazing skills from your career and your experience as a patient and a PPV member all into, you know, bringing the work that you're doing at the minute alive.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, we do hope to, I mean, the PPV would fail if it didn't make a difference. Mm-hmm. So, that's where, and the challenge for us is the metrics.
Mm-hmm.
What we're going to measure? So it goes back to, you know, I've got a business degree, so I'm very interested in, you know, what's your unique selling point? What's your key metric? You know, how are you going to measure? If you don't measure it, you'll never know if it's working. So one of the things we're doing at PPV is, what's the metric of mm-hmm. success, or what are the metrics of success?
Mm-hmm.
So that's absolutely right, Helen.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Eddie. It's been a fantastic conversation to have with you.
Thank you. Well, I hope it's helpful. Yeah. Great.
Thanks for joining us today. If you would like more information about the topics that we have discussed, then you can find these at our website, www.ny-genomics.org/podcasts, where you'll also find all the episodes in our podcast series. These can also be found on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all other podcast platforms.